Good evening, my friends, and welcome to Hitchens on Horror. I am your host, Josh Hitchens, and tonight we're doing a deep dive into Friday the 13th, Part 2. Welcome back to the podcast, my friends. I'm very excited to continue our series doing a deep dive into each of the first 8 Friday the 13th movies, encompassing the films that were made in the 1980s. I'm going to start off this episode with a section that I'm going to call Last Remains, where at the beginning of an episode, I will talk about things that I forgot meant to talk about in the previous episode, but forgot or didn't get around to. Thank you all for listening to the first episode last week, where we talked about Friday the 13th, the first movie made in 1980. And when I talked about that, I talked about how the movie is in some ways haunted by Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. And I talked about two of the ways that it is, but I forgot to talk about the third way, which is kind of the most important one, so I want to talk about it here, and it has to do with the character of Mrs. Voorhees herself. Victor Miller, who wrote the first Friday the 13th, wrote Mrs. Voorhees as a very deliberate inversion of Psycho and its killer, because of course, as I'm sure if you're listening to this, everybody knows, in Psycho, Norman Bates kills his mother and develops a multiple personality, maybe, where he thinks he is her and he becomes her and kills people and then forgets and tries to cover up his mother's murders. And in the first Friday the 13th, Victor Miller inverted that, where it's not the son who's doing the killing, it's the mother. And the mother has that scene, has that moment near the end of Friday the 13th, the first one, where she's speaking in Jason's voice, the whole, kill her, mommy, kill her, there's no place to hide, all of that, expertly done by Betsy Palmer. So he typically, inverted, you know, that where it's the mother kind of possessed by the son instead of the son being possessed by the mother as it is in Psycho, which is interesting. And Victor Miller also said, he revealed this in the documentary Crystal Lake Memories, which if you haven't watched it, you absolutely must. It is over 6 hours long, hugely, hugely comprehensive look at the entirety of the series, interviewing pretty much everybody involved in the series who was still alive at the time the documentary was made. But in that documentary, and in the book it was based on, also called Crystal Lake Memories, Victor Miller realized later, he said, with the help of a very good therapist, that in writing the character of Mrs. Voorhees in Friday the 13th, he had unconsciously created the kind of mother that he wished he had had, but did not. A mother who would do absolutely anything for her son, which I'm guessing Victor Miller's mother was not that way. But yeah, that is the third way in which the first Friday the 13th is haunted by Psycho. Another thing that I meant to talk about and did not, and could not believe I omitted, is the original script by Victor Miller. Mrs. Voorhees' son was not named Jason. His name was Josh. And Victor Miller changed it because he decided that the name Josh was not sinister enough, which I'm affronted by that, but I get it. And changed it to Jason. There's something about it being two syllables, I think. You know, you have Michael Myers, Freddy Krueger. There's something about the two syllables that, like, helps make it scarier. Josh doesn't sound like a scary name in itself, although I am trying my best to make it so. Victor Miller decided to call the character Jason because he remembered a kid from his childhood named Jason who was, he said, just a little asshole. And so that's why he named him Jason. I also talked about in the when we talked about the first movie, how Betsy Palmer really thought the script was a piece of shit when she first got it, but nonetheless, as I talked about, really put her all into the acting of this movie. It's a really great performance. But in subsequent interviews, she said she's really come around on the whole Friday the 13th thing, and many conventions over the years. And she says, I think it turned out exactly the way it's supposed to, and that more people knew who she was and remembered her because she had played Mrs. Voorhees in Friday the 13th than if she hadn't done the movie. She honestly probably would be a forgotten actor, or at least not nearly as well known as she was. Betsy Palmer also had some choice words for all the critics who lacerated these movies for their violence. She said something I love. She said, those who can do and those who can't criticize. And in the bad reviews section, which we're going to continue to do at the end of every episode of this series on the podcast, I talked about Gene Siskel's review where he, you know, revealed where Betsy Palmer lived and everything. But in that review, he also said that this movie is perpetrated by one of the most despicable creatures ever to infest the movie business, Sean S. Cunningham. Ooh. But Sean S. Cunningham and the studio, Paramount, laughed all the way to the bank. First Friday the 13th movie was a giant, giant success, so it wasn't at all surprising that Paramount wanted a sequel. And prep for Friday the 13th Part 2 began just 4 months after the first movie opened, around October, November 1980. At first, they weren't sure what they were going to do for Friday the 13th Part 2, because they were thinking, you know, what do we do? Almost our entire cast is dead, except for Alice, who survived. The killer is dead. What are we going to do? What's the movie going to be about? The original thought that they had for Friday the 13th Part 2 was that it would be a completely new setting, a completely new story based around the idea of Friday the 13th superstition, it being unlucky, you know, entirely new situation, no Camp Crystal Lake, no counselors, just something completely different, more of an anthology of Friday the 13th films. But they decided against that, and it's good that they did, because as I'm sure all y'all horror fans know, John Carpenter tried that with Halloween 3 Season of the Witch, which did not have Michael Myers in it. And it's a really great movie on its own. I'm one of the people that really love Halloween 3 Season of the Witch, but it was not popular at the time because they'd had Halloween and Halloween 2, which had Michael Myers, and then Halloween 3, no Michael Myers. And people were like, what the fuck? So Friday the 13th avoided that trap, and they decided what they would do is to retcon it a little bit and say, what if Jason did not actually drown? What if Jason did not die? What if Jason had been alive all this time in the woods surrounding Camp Crystal Lake and saw his mother be murdered, and now he is killing teenagers like the teenagers that killed his mother? That was the idea they decided to go with. Now, there's a problem, though. Victor Miller, who wrote the first movie, Sean S. Cunningham, who directed the first movie, and Tom Savini, who did the special gore effects for the first movie, all, and Betsy Palmer, too, honestly, all hated this idea. They thought it was absolutely ridiculous that after everything that had happened, you know, Mrs. Voorhees going on a murder spree, now Jason is alive. Tom Savini has a really fun quote. He's like, what was he doing? Like, surviving on crayfish from the lake for 35 years? No one noticed this weird-looking kid? So Sean S. Cunningham decided not to direct Friday the 13th Part 2 and actually would not have really any main involvement in any Friday the 13th movie until Jason Goes to Hell in 1993, which we will not be covering on this podcast because it is terrible and not in a fun way. Victor Miller, who wrote Friday the 13th, decided not to write the second one. Tom Savini also chose not to return to do the special effects makeup. Instead, went on to do another slasher movie called The Burning, which is excellent. Kind of one of the early imitators of Friday the 13th in a way, but is absolutely worth watching on its own. Check out The Burning. So, who's going to write and direct Friday the 13th Part 2? And unfortunately, they had people who worked on the first movie who were kind of waiting in the wings and stepped in very well. Steve Miner, who had been an associate producer on Friday the 13th Part 1, was signed on to direct Part 2, his very first movie as a director. He was very young at the time. The crew apparently called him the Kid. And the movie was written by Ron Kurtz, who had done uncredited rewrites on the first Friday the 13th movie. He wrote this script. And they both do a really, really great job, I think. Steve Miner would actually return to direct the next movie, Friday the 13th Part 3. He's the only person who has directed more than one Friday the 13th film. We also have some returning cast members for Friday the 13th Part 2. Adrian King as Alice, Walt Gorney as Crazy Ralph, and Betsy Palmer returns as Mrs. Voorhees. And then we got a whole other crop of folks that we're going to talk about. Now, this movie was released on April 30th, 1981. They filmed it for $1.25 million, and it grossed $21.7 million. Huge, huge profit. And the poster for the movie said, "The body count continues," which I love. And the producer of this movie, Frank Mancuso Jr., who would become a hugely influential steward of this franchise from this point onward, said of the Friday the 13th movies, "We wanted it to be an event where teenagers would flock to the theaters to see the next episode." And this is another way in which I think the Friday the 13th franchise is innovative, because the idea of another movie coming out every year, year after year, was a new one, had not been done before this. Like, the first Halloween came out in 1978. Halloween 2 did not come out until 1981, just a few months after Friday the 13th Part 2 was released. So it was really this interesting idea that every year, every spring or summer, you're going to have a new Friday the 13th movie. Because Tom Savini turned down the job of doing the special effects makeup for this movie, they hired Stan Winston, also a obviously brilliant, brilliant special effects makeup designer. At this point, he had done the first Alien movie, which I think is one of the most scariest movies ever made for me. But Stan Winston then became busy and he could not do the special makeup effects for Friday the 13th Part 2. Stan Winston eventually went on to win an Academy Award for Best Makeup for Aliens, also worked on The Terminator, Predator, Jurassic Park, amazing career. So the third choice to do makeup for Friday the 13th Part 2 was Carl Fullerton, who was not totally new, but certainly not as experienced as Tom Savini or Stan Winston at this time. Carl Fullerton did a very, very good job with the makeup for Friday the 13th Part 2, although very, very sadly, you don't get to see a lot of the work he did, because the MPAA really, forgive the pun, butchered this movie. They required 48 seconds of gore footage to be deleted from Friday the 13th Part 2 before they would give it an R rating. And I think, honestly, that is one of the problems I have with this movie, especially following the first Friday the 13th, where you have, even in its slightly cut version where you lose 11 seconds, really amazing moments and scenes of gore effects. And in Friday the 13th Part 2, a lot of the kills, it's almost you blink and you miss the money shot. And that is not Carl Fullerton's fault. That is the MPAA's fault for messing up this movie. But I think that's one of the reasons why I rate Friday 13th Part 2 personally a little bit lower than the first one. Because it really does not do justice to the gore and the kills, although there are some amazing kill situations in this movie, which we'll get into. Carl Fullerton eventually went on to do makeup for Glory, The Godfather Part 3, and The Silence of the Lambs, so eventually became part of the Hollywood makeup A-list, along with Tom Savini and Stan Winston. The 48 seconds that were deleted from Friday the 13th Part 2 were thought to be lost for many, many, many years until Carl Fullerton discovered them on a VHS he had saved, the original footage, and on the recent Scream Factory release of the entire Friday the 13th franchise, that footage was included as an extra into the film. I wish it was able to be restored and put back into the movie, because I think that would make this movie even better. Friday the 13th Part 2 was filmed in New Preston and Kent, Connecticut. So, like the first movie, which was filmed in New Jersey, Friday the 13th Part 2, I think, has an authenticity to it because it was filmed on the East Coast at an actual summer camp. Again, they're not sets. Like, these are all buildings that existed, and that reality lends something to this movie and to the first movie that you lose after this movie, because starting with Part 3, they filmed them in Los Angeles, and you can tell. You can tell the difference. But unlike in Friday the 13th, Tom Savini and his assistant were the only people that actually stayed at the camp while they were making the movie. For Friday the 13th Part 2, everybody, the cast and the crew, all stayed at the camp together. And they described it as being very, 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 very creepy. Amy Steele, who plays Jenny in this movie, we'll talk more about her in a bit, but she described it as it was like living at night for 3 solid months, and it became very creepy. All right, my friends, I've talked long enough. Let's get to this movie. And as with the first film last week, we are going to watch this movie together. I've done an introduction, and I'm going to tell you where to pause the movie, and I'll give background and trivia making of stuff in between. So we're going to watch this as if we're watching it together. Now, unfortunately, in between now and last week, Paramount Plus and Showtime no longer have the streaming rights to the Friday the 13th franchise, which sucks. So until they pop up somewhere else, and I'll let you know when they do, but this week at least, you're on your own, my friends. I have the series on DVD, so that is how I am watching it. You can get the full series on DVD pretty inexpensively. You can also rent or purchase them through Amazon Prime Video or YouTube, things like that. So that's an option for you. But before we start the movie and get our popcorn ready, let's do our body count. Body count for Friday the 13th Part 2. There are 9 dead bodies, or maybe 10. That is up to debate. We'll get into why. And the methods of murder in Friday the 13th Part 2. Among them are stabbed with an ice pick, strangled to death with barbed wire, a hammer to the head, throat slit with machete to the face, double impaling via spear, and knife to the chest. And the dog might die in this movie. Or maybe the dog doesn't die. That is also slightly a mystery, which we'll get into later. All right, my friends, we are going to start the movie now, and you're going to pause the movie when it gets to 13 minutes and 50 seconds. All right, let's see what Alice is up to, shall we? All right, so this movie begins 2 months after Friday the 13th Part 1 ends. We start in August 1979. And this movie has, I think, a wonderfully creepy and atmospheric beginning to it. You have a little girl at night who's jumping puddles, singing the Itsy Bitsy Spider. Mom says, get in the house. She's like, oh, Mom. And then she goes into the house, and then we have the very first shot of Jason. We see Jason's feet walking into frame right as the little girl leaves, and his ominous footsteps walking towards this creepy-looking house. Very, very effective ending. Again, I think Steve Miner does a wonderful job directing this film. Now, the person who plays Jason in this sequence is not... this is the only movie where three actors play Jason. And the first actor who plays Jason in this sequence that you just watched is the only time Jason so far has been played by a woman. In the opening shots, Jason was played by Ellen Lutter, who's the costume designer for this movie. She plays Jason, because I don't think they had anyone else to do it at this point. This movie's also really smart in that it basically gives you, as Alice is having her nightmare, it gives you a recap of part one. So if you had not seen part one, you get the gist of it in the very first couple minutes of this movie, which is great storytelling. I love the nod when you're looking around Alice's apartment, you see her sketches, remembering that she was an artist. She was sketching and drawing in the first movie as well. I love that they preserved that part of her character. And we see her go take a shower again, another nod to Psycho. And the interesting thing about this scene is that it is almost entirely improvised. Adrian King, who plays Alice, coming back from the first movie, she, as she has said, had told the producers and creators that she was there, she would do anything in the sequel that they wanted her to do, but she never got a script, and she thought that was a little odd. There's also another story that her agent was asking for a lot of money. It's a little unclear what happened. But Adrian King arrived on set to film, again, not having seen any script. And she found that the set was basically empty. Almost everyone had left. Almost everyone in the crew had left. That's actually probably why Ellen Lutter, the costume designer, played Jason, because the other actors who play Jason have probably been sent home by this point, because they had filmed the movie already. They'd filmed the entire movie except for this opening sequence. And that was when Adrian King found out that Jason was going to kill her, that Alice was going to die. So they had her improvise the entire phone conversation with her mother about trying to get a new start, trying to move on with her life after the trauma of the massacre at Camp Crystal Lake. All improv. So Alice gets out of the shower, and there's a classic kitty jump scare. Love those. Gotta have those in a slasher movie. But then she opens the fridge to get some milk, and she sees the decomposing head of Mrs. Voorhees. And they actually did do another cast of Betsy Palmer's head for this particular scene with the head in the fridge. And then you see Jason jam an ice pick into poor Alice's brain. And the very first time, they had to shoot this twice. Very first time they shot it, the ice pick, which was supposed to be retractable, the actor playing Jason stabbed Adrian King in the head with it, and the ice pick did not retract, actually injured Adrian King. And the second time they filmed the scene, the actor had to be told to actually aim for the hole in Adrian King's head. Poor thing. I think Alice deserved a little bit better than she got here. She's such a great character from the first film. Sad to see her go, especially sad to see her go so quickly in the very opening sequence of part two. And I do love that at the end of this sequence, Jason takes the hissing kettle off of the stove. Very nice nod to the scene in the first movie when Alice is making tea. There's a lot of really nice echoes of the first movie in part two as well that I'll be pointing out as we go. There is another potential reason why Adrienne King may not have been as heavily involved in Friday the 13th Part 2 as she could have been. Adrienne King has, in recent years, come out with a story of what happened to her, in that after the first Friday the 13th was released, she gradually realized that she had a stalker. She was getting weird phone calls at her house. Her apartment was broken into. Just became aware someone was watching her, an obsessive fan. And this stalker actually worked his way into her life, befriended her to such a degree that she would talk to her stalker about the stalking that she was experiencing. And Adrienne King has said, she said this in the Crystal Lake Memories documentary, that eventually things reached a climax when he was with her in her apartment and he put a gun to her head. And she said that she eventually was able to talk him down, to put the gun down, and was able to get law enforcement. But this incident traumatized her to such a degree that she basically stopped acting for decades. Till later on, she started doing a lot of voice acting work. But she didn't appear at conventions for decades because of this incident. But she has gone on the record in saying that, you know, everything is okay now, that now she feels really great and loves the fans who really listen to her story and tell them how much it means to them for her to share that story and thank her for the amazing work that she's done in these films. So Adrienne King, wherever you are, we love you. You're great. The opening credits for Friday the 13th Part 2 don't actually begin until 12 minutes into the movie, so it's a pretty extended sequence before you reach the opening credits. It begin with the classic fade to white that the first movie established and that I love, and then you get the Friday the 13th Part 2, and then it explodes, which I think is a really great touch. I quite love that. Because I think it's a signal that in this movie, especially after Alice, the original final girl, she's been killed, Jason is alive apparently, we're in a whole different world of Friday the 13th now. Now, the interesting thing about what we're about to see when the film picks up after the credits end is that it is 5 years later. And that's one of the fun things about the Friday the 13th franchise, is working out its timeline. Because the first movie we know canonically happens in June 1979. This scene with Alice happens in August 1979. Then we go to 5 years later. The rest of Friday the 13th Part 2 happens, therefore, in the summer of 1984. This movie came out in 1981, so the bulk of Friday the 13th Part 2 is thus set 3 years into the future, in the summer of 1984, which I think is pretty fun. All right, my friends, let's meet our new cast here. We're going to come back 27 minutes in, and we'll talk about all the wonderful folks who are in this movie, but first, you're going to meet them. See ya in 27 minutes, my friends. All right. So, again, we are now in June of 1984, 3 years into the future, if you were watching this movie when it came out in 1981. And we've been introduced to our cast of characters who are going to get sliced and diced by Jason in Friday the 13th Part 2. This cast is led by Amy Steele as Ginny Field, one of the great great performances of the Friday the 13th franchise. Really, I think one of the most memorable final girls in slasher movie history. And the character Ginny Field is actually named after the production designer of Friday the 13th parts 1 and 2, Virginia Field, which I think is a lovely, lovely, lovely tribute to a production designer to have the main character named after her. And the character Ginny Field is a camp counselor with a background in psychology. So as we know, the premise is that Camp Crystal Lake, 5 years later, has been abandoned, condemned. But nearby on the other side, or near Camp Crystal Lake, they've built another, there's another summer camp that is a training camp for camp counselors. We'll just do a camp right next to the place where all the murders happen. That'll be okay. So Ginny has a background in psychology, which is very interesting because many years later, after she decided to slow down on the acting, Amy Steele went back to school and became a psychotherapist, and has been doing that for many years, the same profession as Ginny, the character she is most often known for. Amy Steele gave a great interview to Dread Central, where she talked about Ginny. She said, "I like Ginny because she wasn't a total bimbo. She was smart and confident, and you know she had something driving her. I was really young and different from a lot of the people working at that time, so that came out in my character. I was naturally suspicious of cocky guys at that age, and you see a lot of that when I'm on screen with Paul. I tried to put so much behind the actual words in the script, just so she felt almost unreachable to Paul and audiences. I wanted her to have some power, and that what was called for was who you were as a person in these films." She's great. Amy Steele, applause, applause, applause for her. Playing Paul is John Fury, who's the head camp counselor, older, also has a relation, a romantic interest with Ginny, and she and Amy Steele and John Fury have really, really great chemistry together. You can tell that there's a real affection there. John Fury has a ton of TV credits. If you look at his Wikipedia page, he's one of those actors that really has never stopped working. We also have Stu Charno as the character Ted. Now, if you remember, we talked about in the last episode how the character of Ned in Friday the 13th is really the first time in a slasher movie that you get that archetype of the funny practical joker character. That archetype is back in Friday the 13th Part 2, except his name is not Ned. His name is Ted. Very creative there. Stu Charno auditioned for several roles in this movie. And finally, the director and producers asked him to tell a joke. He told a joke. They laughed and cast him as Ted. And the joke he told is actually in the movie. And he's also, Stu Charno also worked extensively as a stand-up comic. He guest starred in episodes of MASH, episodes of The X-Files, and actually is credited with coming up with the stories for three different episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation as well. All right, we got Russell Todd as Scott, who did some other very, very notable slasher movies, including He Knows You're Alone from 1980, which was the first movie that Tom Hanks was ever in. Russell Todd was also in the beloved classic Chopping Mall from 1986, which is one of those horror movies. It's not a good movie necessarily, but damn, it's fun. If you haven't watched Chopping Mall, check it out. Russell Todd also worked on a lot of soap operas, left acting in 1997, and he started an agency for Steadicam operators, which he still runs today. We have Bill Randolph as Jeff, who I'm just going to be completely transparent. I had a very, very big crush on when I was a teenager. When I first watched this movie, I thought, he was very, very attractive. Still do. Bill Randolph's first movie was Brian De Palma's Dressed to Kill in 1980. 80, and then went on to do Friday the 13th Part 2. Eventually became a graphic designer, including working for the New York Daily News, so another very successful career. Lauren Marie Taylor as Vicky had never been to a summer camp before she was on set for this movie. And during the monologue that Paul does about the legend of Jason, was genuinely really creeped out and terrified during it. Lauren Marie Taylor didn't do that many movies after this, but just 2 years after Friday the 13th Part 2, she became a main cast member on the daytime soap opera Loving, and was on that show from 1983 to its cancellation in 1995. She was the only cast member of Loving to stay for the entire run. And the way that soap opera ended, its final storyline was actually a serial killer storyline, where a serial killer was killing off all the main characters on the show, including the character played by Lauren Marie Taylor. So she came full circle many years later. We also have Tom McBride as Mark. Lauren Marie Taylor, whose character Vicky is very, very romantically interested in Mark. Lauren Marie Taylor, the actor, was also very, very seriously romantically interested in Tom McBride, the actor, unaware at the time that Tom McBride was gay. He was an openly gay actor at the time, also worked as a model for Winston cigarette ads, like Think the Marlboro Man back in the day. Very, very similar to that. Tom McBride died in 1995 of AIDS 2 weeks before his 43rd birthday, and a documentary was made, and it's called Life and Death on the A-List, and it chronicles the final months of his life. He gives a really incredible performance in this movie. I love him, and I'll talk more about him as we go. We have Marta Korber as Sandra. Marta Korber was actually only 16 years old when she made Friday the 13th Part 2. And the producers did not know that she was only 16 when they filmed the movie, because she originally had a full frontal nude scene. Thankfully, sometime before the film was released, Kat got out of the bag, found out that she was underage, and so her nude scene was completely cut out of the film. I mean, and for me, again, this hindsight's 2020, but she definitely looks the youngest out of everybody. Don't know if I quite believe she was 18, and I have to wonder how Bill Randolph as Jeff, her romantic interest in the movie, must have felt after he realized that he'd been acting with an underage actor. We have Kirsten Baker as Terry, who gives the Friday the 13th franchise its very first full frontal nude scene. Because again, the first Friday the 13th doesn't really have much nudity in it at all, but Friday the 13th Part 2 begins the series' reputation of showing a lot of skin. And I really, really tip my hat to Kirsten Baker as Terry, because it's a really brave performance, you know, to do the nudity that she does. Really hats off to her. So those are our main cast members. And I think it's really fun. You know, we have Crazy Ralph come back, played by the great Walt Gourney. And he, one of his few lines in the movie is, "I told the others, they didn't believe me. You're all doomed. You're all doomed." And then Ted's response to that is, "Welcome to God's country." And as they're driving to the camp Crystal Lake, but the camp adjacent to Crystal Lake, they find a tree across the road, almost like there's someone who doesn't want them to come to Crystal Lake, aka Camp Blood. Will they listen? No, of course they won't, because then there wouldn't be a movie. And we very quickly see that someone is watching them. Again, we have that wonderful music from Harry Manfredini, who scored the first film. I love that the place where all the counselors meet is called the Packinac Lodge. I just think that's a fun name. And again, John Furious Paul has the immensely great monologue, you know, around the campfire, classic spooky campfire story of the legend of Jason. And in that monologue, they retcon and rewrite the history of what we now know as Friday the 13th in the best way. It is magnificent, you know, and he said, and it ends with, like, legend has it, Jason saw his mother beheaded that night, and he took his revenge, a revenge that he'll continue to seek if anyone enters his wilderness again, and he's hungry. And then he says it's all a joke. Jason drowned. Mrs. Voorhees was killed. Camp Crystal Lake's off limits. Everything's fine. We'll see about that. And I love that jump scare at the end of the story where Ted jumps out with a spear and a creepy, kind of deformed human face mask, a foreshadowing of things to come. This movie does foreshadowing quite well, actually, and we'll talk more about that as we go. All right, my friends, let's get back to the movie. You're going to pause when we reach 42 minutes and 44 seconds. See you then. I love that when they go back into the lodge, Ted puts his Jason mask on top of the spear after the prank where he jumps out, leaves it at the bottom of the chairs. Ooh, I wonder if that's going to come into play later on. It's Chekhov's spear, everybody. We meet Muffin, a very, very cute dog. I also enjoy that less than a minute after Paul's Jason story where he says, oh, it's all a myth, Jason's dead, Mrs. Voorhees is dead, everything's fine. Less than a minute after that, we see Jason's POV looking at the teenagers through the open window, and he is fixated on Ginny sitting in the chair for a moment. And while Scott is holding Muffin in his arms, trying to get Terry's attention, Muffin looks out the window where Jason is and whimpers. If only people had listened to Muffin, none of this would have happened. Love that Paul's mystified when Ginny beats him at chess. Again, Ginny showing very early on that Ginny is a very strong character, incredibly smart, and is not going to take any shit from any of these men. Really wonderful fake scare scene of Paul suddenly appearing in Ginny's cabin at night. Still kind of creepy. And there's a great echo kind of the Alice and Steve relationship from Friday the 13th, part one, that romantic relationship. And we see Crazy Ralph again very, very briefly. He's outside watching Ginny and Paul. And then he is the second person to die in this movie. But the first person that is killed during this massacre 5 years after the first, by barbed wire, strangling with barbed wire around the neck. I think I've always thought that it's such a shame that they kill Crazy Ralph off, really at all, but that they kill Crazy Ralph off so early in Friday the 13th part 2. He gets like two lines to say in the movie and then he's dead. And I think that's just, what a waste of a great actor, Walt Gorney. But we're not quite done with Crazy Ralph. Just stay tuned for the rest of this series. We might just be hearing him again. After Crazy Ralph dies, we have another fade to white, and then it's the next day, which is a different thing from the first movie, because the first movie very famously takes place over a 24-hour period. Again, the original title being considered was Long Night at Camp Blood. But Friday 13th Part 2, in its present day, 5 years later, setting after the opening credits, happens actually across 2 days. One day that goes into night, then starts the next day, and then we go into another night of terror. I wonder What was Muffin doing alone in the woods? Like, why isn't Terry taking care of her dog? And we see Muffin run into Jason, and then there's a smash cut to hot dogs roasting on the grill, which... it's very clever. I'm like, Muffin. We also then see immediately after that Ginny cutting logs with a chainsaw, which again is a nice bit of foreshadowing. Terry eventually starts looking for Muffin. She's calling for Muffin. Then, you know, someone says, hey, lunch is ready. She's like, okay. And immediately walks off. Stop. She's like, oh, fuck this dog. It's lunchtime. Love that we have the scene, another scene that echoes the first movie of all the counselors having fun together at the lake. Jeff and Sandra sneak off to see the abandoned, forbidden Camp Blood, and they find on their way a mangled dog that sure does look a lot like Muffin. But is it Muffin? We'll wait till the end of the movie. We'll see. And then they run into a police officer. And in the original script, and in fact in the credits for this movie, this character is just called The Cop. But there was a novelization of Friday the 13th Part 2 that eventually came out. And in the novelization, they gave the cop the name of Deputy Winslow, which is what he's been known as since. And Deputy Winslow is played by an actor named Jack Marks, who, again, it's an echo of the first movie where the cop comes by and warns them, we have that again. And he says, things have been quiet for 5 years, and that's the way we want to keep it. And I love when he brings Jeff and Sandra to Paul, you know, because they've been trying to trespass at Camp Crystal Lake. And Paul says, all right, you can go to lunch now. And the cop says, no punishment? What kind of place is this? There'll be plenty of punishment later on. Jack Marks has gone on the record saying that in this movie is the first and the only time in his life that he's ever driven a car, which is funny because, again, the actor who played the cop in Friday the 13th Part 1 had never been on a motorcycle before, and you could totally tell. But they go a little easier on Jack Marks as Deputy Winslow. He's not seen driving for long because then he sees Jason running across the road into the woods. And it's the first time we see Jason not just, like, from the knees down. We actually see the full body for a second. And so Deputy Winslow decides to run through the woods pursuing Jason. And he runs through a puddle, which again is great foreshadowing because it's going to come up again later. Runs through a puddle and then finds himself at Jason's hideaway shack. And as Deputy Winslow is exploring it, there's even a bathroom. Somehow Jason figured out how to rig up a toilet in the years since he supposedly drowned. And then Deputy Winslow opens a door in the shack, and there's another room. And we don't see what he sees, but he looks around, has this horrified look on his face. He says, oh my God. And then Jason comes up behind him and kills Deputy Winslow with a hammer to the skull. 3 people dead, 5 or 6 to go, depending on your interpretation. And I love, again, what this moment in the movie does is that we've had Crazy Ralph is now dead. You know, the prophet who is warning them that they're doomed to stay away. He's been silenced forever. Deputy Winslow, the police officer, you know, who could help them, he's now been killed. So now there is no one to protect the teenagers or save them from the wrath of Jason Voorhees. Now, we're going to return to the movie, and you're going to pause it when we're at 1 hour, 1 minute, and 10 seconds. Okay. Enjoy. See you at 1 hour, 1 minute, in 10 seconds, my friends. So one of the things that I love and praise about the first Friday the 13th movie is that you really do get to know all of its characters, the camp counselors, and you like them all. They seem, you know, just like regular, real people that you'd want to hang out with. And Friday the 13th Part 2 still has a flair of that. I think, again, the movie suffers a bit because of the runtime. It's 86 minutes long and is technically the shortest movie in the franchise. And I do wish that this movie was a little bit longer, actually, just to get some more character development in there. Because in the first movie, at least in my opinion, because you really care about all these characters, when they're killed, that really registers with you, has an emotional impact. And that is not always true in Friday the 13th Part 2. It's very hit and miss. Sometimes it registers, sometimes it's just, oh, now that person's dead, I vaguely remember them. But there is some really good character development happening in the section we just watched. So after dinner, Paul says, "Today was fun games, tomorrow it gets serious. Anyone want a last night on the town? Now's your chance." So half the cast goes to the bar in town, and the other half stays behind at the camp to get slaughtered. I love all the scenes between Vicky and Mark, played by Lauren Marie Taylor and Tom McBride, respectively. It's probably the best acting in the movie, aside from Amy Steele, maybe even surpassing her, honestly, because they have such a genuine connection. You really believe that they're falling in love, that there is a playful sexual attraction between them that is just a lovely story to behold. And I love that Mark is a really wonderful depiction of a differently abled character. You know, he's in a wheelchair. You know, says, like, "Nothing spoils a party quicker than a drunk in a wheelchair." Vicky says, that's crap. "Look, we can go together if you want." Mark says, "I appreciate that." She says, "I'm staying too." So they decide to stay together. But he talks, you know, he wins the arm wrestling with Jeff. Two times. So he's not depicted as like a pathetic, like, oh, poor me, I'm in a wheelchair. He's the opposite of that. You know, he doesn't let it define him. He is still himself, even though he can't use his legs anymore. And I think that's really a wonderful, wonderful character. He incidentally is wearing a jersey with the number 81 on it. Again, this movie came out in 1981. I don't know if that was intentional or not, but if it is, good on the costume designer, a.k.a. the first person to play Jason in Friday the 13th Part 2. Terry decides to go for a walk alone at night and go skinny dipping in Camp Crystal Lake. And it is a full moon on Friday the 13th, just as it was in the first movie. Really nice call out to that. And she gets out of the lake and discovers that Scott has taken her clothes. And then he gets caught in a booby trap and is hanging upside down from a tree branch, which presumably was set by Jason. And I love that Terry says, "I ought to let you hang, you pervert." And then she goes off to get help. And then Scott gets killed by Jason with a machete to the throat. This is historic because it is the first time Jason Voorhees uses a machete in this franchise. But if you look close, you'll notice he's using the wrong side of the machete. He's not using the actual blade. He's using the dull top side of it to slit Scott's throat. I'm guessing maybe it was because it was a real machete. They didn't have the budget to find a fake one. I don't know. That's one of those really funny things that you notice after watching this a couple times. Jeff and Sandra decide to go upstairs to have some fun together, and Vicky and Mark are left alone. And they have, I love this scene, this wonderful conversation. She says, "Want to take me on? Sure, have a seat. I only want your fingers." And she gives him the video game that Ted was playing. And Mark says, "Which one do you prefer?" And Vicky replies, "The one with the puck." I love her line delivery. And Mark says, "You mean hockey? What do you want to play for?" And she says, "Position." It's such a wonderful, wonderful scene. And I also think it's kind of fun in that moment that we bring up hockey and Jason eventually adopts the hockey mask. Not until the next movie, but it's fun that this is hockey is mentioned for the very first time. And we have Terry discovering the bot Scott and Jason. Then there's a smash cut to the bar. So it's interesting that we don't see Terry die. And I don't think we ever actually see her body again in the movie. Again, a nice echo, I think, back to the first movie, because Friday the 13th is very interesting in that there are some kills that you see right up close, like Scott having his throat cut with the machete, the wrong end of the machete. But then there are some kills, like after a big one or two, that you see where you don't see it. Let your imagination do the work, which I think is very, very smart, that it's not just it's not a nonstop gore fest. It lets you wonder what happened, and your imagination can think of something much more terrible than you could see on screen. And I, in this bar scene, is one of maybe the best monologues in this franchise, delivered by Amy Steele as Ginny. And I'm just going to read it very briefly, but she's at the bar. And again, she's a psychologist, so she has an insight into this that the other characters do not. She says, "What if there is a Jason? What if there is some boy or beast running around Camp Crystal Lake? Let's try to think beyond the legend. Put it in real terms. What would he be like today? The only person he'd ever known was his mother. He never went to school, never had any friends. She was everything to him. I doubt Jason would have even known the meaning of death. At least not until that horrible night. He must have seen the whole thing happen. He must have seen his mother get killed, and all because she loved him. Isn't that what her revenge was all about? Her sense of loss, her rage at what she thought happened, her love for him. And he must be out there right now, crying for her return, for her resurrection." That is so important, and is, I think, maybe the pivotal moment of this entire franchise, of which everything that comes after it sits on. And it's what I think makes the Friday the 13th franchise different from the Halloween franchise and from Nightmare on Elm Street. Because in Halloween, Michael Myers is like this emotionless killer. He is the shape, just total evil, compelled to kill. And then we find out that Laurie Strode is his sister, which personally I think was a mistake to reveal that in Halloween 2. But we'll talk about that another time, perhaps. And Nightmare on Elm Street, we have Freddy Krueger's backstory, that he is the bastard son of, 10,000 maniacs or whatever, and it was a child molester who is burned alive by the parents to stop him, and then comes back and kills the teenagers through their dreams. So, again, like, very, very evil characters. Both of them are. But Friday the 13th, the motivation for all the killing and all the slashing and slicing and dicing is different from those two in that it is actually based on real emotion and love and pain. Ginny is right in that Mrs. Voorhees killed all those people because, she believed that those people were responsible for her son dying, losing her only child. And so she's killing out of revenge and grief for that. And now, starting in Friday the 13th, Part 2, in the world that we're living in now in this new canon, Jason is killing teenagers. He is killing people like the people that murdered his own mother, the only person who ever loved him, who he ever knew. So there's a real human aspect to the motivation here that is not present really in any other slasher franchise that I can think of, honestly. And I think that's part of what makes Friday the 13th really, really special. go back to the lodge, more fun banter between Mark and Vicky. Laura Marie Taylor really hilariously in a scene pulls out a joint and says, "Toke?" And Laura Marie Taylor has said, like, she had never smoked pot in her life, and that everyone in the cast and crew laughed at her when she did that because she clearly had no idea she were doing. She and Mark decide to spend the night together, and Vicky goes to her own cabin to get a couple things. Then a storm begins. Again, another echo back to part one. We have the thunderstorm beginning just as things are starting to go down. And, of course, this being Friday the 13th, Vicky has to run around, including running around outside, you know, wearing a shirt but no pants, just her panties. And then we have two of the most iconic kills in Friday the 13th history happening right back to back to one another. First, we have the murder of Mark, played by Tom McBride. So sad to see him go. But he gets a machete to the face outside by Jason. And the shot, you know, in the pouring rain of him with a machete in his face and the wheelchair going down these, you know, rickety wooden stairs is one of the most, I think, beautiful and iconic shots of the entire franchise. Then Jason enters the house and, what do you know, finds that spear that Ted conveniently left around earlier. And Jason takes the spear and kills Jeff and Sandra. And they're having sex on the bed and just plunges the spear through both of their bodies, through the bed. And we see the tip of the spear, you know, dripping with blood, hit the floor of the room. Now, this is one of the scenes that was really, again, butchered by the MPAA. You see almost nothing of it. There are still photographs. The footage has been found since, and there's still photographs of this scene. But it was originally much, much gorier. You know, really takes the death of Kevin Bacon, where he gets the arrow through the neck in part one, and like takes it to a whole other level, makes it even better, even more grisly and badass. There's a very similar kill, some might say identical kill, in Mario Bava's movie Twitch of the Death Nerve, which is also known as A Bay of Blood. But Steve Miner and Ron Kurtz claimed that they had not seen that movie when they wrote and directed Friday the 13th Part 2. So maybe coincidence, but it's an interesting coincidence. Now, when we go back to the bar, one interesting thing is Paul and Ginny walk out of the bar. You see a figure walk into the bar as they're leaving. And that is actually Bill Randolph, who played Jeff, who just got killed like a minute ago. Convinced Steve Miner to let him walk through that scene because no one would be thinking that it was him because he just got murdered. So that's a fun little bit of trivia there. And Ted stay, and it's interesting because Ted stays at the bar, as we're about to see, and thus avoids the slaughter, avoids getting killed. And this might be the only time in Friday the 13th history that the person who parties actually gets to live, which is really fun. All right, my friends, we're going now to watch the rest of this movie, the conclusion of Friday the 13th Part 2, and we're going to come back at the end of the movie to wrap things up. Refill your popcorn, refill your drinks. We got a lot of death coming our way at Camp Blood. See you after the credits. Poor Vicky, played by Lauren Marie Taylor, walks back into the cabin and says, "Is anybody still here?" And the answer is, no one alive anyway. And then we get the first reveal of Jason, where we see him see the face for the first time. And Jason is wearing a burlap sack over his head with one hole where you can see one of his eyes. Really creepy image. There's a great shot you know, of the focusing on his hand holding the butcher knife as it gets closer and closer to Vicky as she's screaming in the corner. But again, the knife is being held upside down from how you'd normally use it. Maybe that's just a killer thing. I don't know. But with the upside down machete, it does make one wonder. And let's talk a little bit about the look of Jason in this movie. Because again, this is the first time we see serial killer Jason and does not have the iconic hockey mask yet. We're not there yet. He has the burlap sack over his head because they decided to go with the idea from the dream making the dream sequence at the end of part one where deformed child Jason jumps out at the lake at Alice. They decide to make that part of the new canon, and that Jason looks very deformed. So to hide his deformity, they figured that what would make most sense is that he would use a burlap sack to cover his face with, because that is something that he would have had on hand. There's precedent for this look in horror history and in real history as well. So the burlap sack over the head is also nearly identical to the image used for the killer in the 1976 movie, The Town That Dreaded Sundown, which if you have not seen it, watch it. It's a great, great movie. In Town That Dreaded Sundown, the killer has eye holes for both eyes, though. Jason only has the one. And The Town That Dreaded Sundown is based on a real series of murders that happened in, I believe, the 50s, if I remember correctly, called the Texarkana Moonlight Murders. There's a great documentary out there called Killer Legends, and one of the stories that they talk about in that documentary is the Texarkana murders, which inspired The Town That Dreaded Sundown. It's a dramatized retelling of that series of crimes. And the killer was never officially caught for those crimes. They have ideas of who it may have been, but no one has ever been definitively depicted as the killer in Texarkana. But there's also an earlier historical precedent for, you know, the sack over the head look, and that is in the Victorian era, the Elephant Man, Joseph Merrick, sometimes known as John Merrick, you know, when he was appeared outside in public, would wear the sack over his head and a giant cloak to disguise the immense physical deformities that he has. So I think that's a really nice echo and informs who this character Jason is, that this is, he's still human, right? Which he's not always going to be as the series progresses. But in Friday the 13th Part 2, he is a boy who has survived out in the woods, made a life for himself, watched his mother die, but is still perhaps ashamed of his facial deformity, the way he looks, so he has a need to disguise it. And also just looks really creepy, too. And the scene when Vicky, played by Laura Marie Taylor, is being dragged down the stairs by Jason, he was actually dragging her body down the stairs in that point. Love when Ginny and Paul get back and find all the lights out. Ginny says, "Paul, there's someone in this room." And they're sounding like, "Paul, there's someone in this fucking room." And then, of course, Jason jumps out and incapacitates Paul. See Jason wielding a pitchfork for the first time. It will not be the last. Love that Ginny, again, another fun echo to the first movie. Ginny finds the corpse of Crazy Ralph in the pantry, and in the first movie, there's a jump scare where Crazy Ralph has been hiding in the pantry. They open the door, and he walks out. And now, on Friday the 13th Part 2, we find him dead in the pantry. There's a really famous scene of Ginny hiding under the bed while Jason's going around it, and then a rat comes right in front of her face, and then you see a shot and it looks like there's urine coming out from under the bed, and there's great debate among the fandom. It's never been clarified. Is that Ginny peeing herself, or is it the rat peeing? The rat then scurries away. I'll just say, in my own opinion, that looks like a lot of urine for a rat to produce, and that urine that you see on film was actually Coca-Cola. That's what they used. And then in the fight, you see Ginny use the chainsaw. We saw her use the chainsaw on the logs earlier. Now she's using it against Jason, running away. And as she's going through the woods, we see her run through a puddle. And again, excellent foreshadowing with the scene with the cop before, because we know she's running through that puddle. She's running right to Jason's shack. And she discovers, and we get to see, the room that the cop discovered and said, oh my God, it is a room where there is an altar, where there is the severed head of Mrs. Voorhees surrounded by candles. Severed head is actually played by an actor named Kerry Hogan in makeup and a wig. It's not the prosthetic head of Betsy Palmer that was used in the first sequence of this movie. It's an actor, Kerry Hogan, playing the head of Mrs. Voorhees. What a fun film credit to have on your resume. But around this altar with the head, there are also sort of piles, almost a pyramid of corpses, including the very decomposed body of Alice. And you can tell it's Alice because you can clearly see the ice pick sticking out of her head. Very decomposed, again, because she's been dead for 5 years at this point. And this is where Ginny really becomes, I think, truly famous as a final girl, because she comes up with a brilliant strategy, again, with her background as a psychologist and knowing the story of Jason. She takes the rotting sweater of Mrs. Voorhees, just imagine what that must have smelled like, puts it on, positions herself in front of the severed head, and talks to Jason as if he is her mother. And then we see that it starts to work, that we see Jason start to see not Amy Steele as Ginny, but to see Betsy Palmer as Mrs. Voorhees speaking to him. Betsy Palmer actually, many, many years later at a convention, completely forgot that she was in Friday the 13th Part 2. She said she never did any movie other than the first one. But you can understand, because they only booked her for, I think, half a day to a day on this film. They flew her to Los Angeles, gave her the lines, and filmed her in front of a black background for this movie. But even in the brief moments where you see Betsy Palmer's Mrs. Voorhees again, still a great performance. Again, this part of the movie could easily be a joke and not work, and it really works thanks to both Betsy Palmer and Amy Steele in this moment. You see why Jason could be convinced. And I love the shots as this scene's going on. It really focuses in on Jason's single eye that you can see. And again, now I can't stress this enough, that like it almost becomes a little bit moving. You almost feel bad that Jason is being tricked in this way. Like, you see the love he and longing for his mother in that single eye as, you know, this scene is going on. It's still very human. Like, this is not a supernatural killing machine yet. This is still a guy. This is still a guy who lost his mother. This final fight between Ginny and Jason actually sent the actor who played Jason to the hospital. The moment when they're, you know, hitting with the pickaxe and the shovel went wrong. The actor playing Jason hurt his finger. They had to they stopped shooting. They went to the emergency room, and all the doctors and nurses were horrified because the actor playing Jason had a machete, you know, in his chest. And he's like, no, it's my finger. But they stitched him up, and Jason and Ginny went back to set and they finished filming the scene. And Ginny gets the final kill, killing Jason with the machete. And I love the moment where she takes the sack off his head to see his face, but we the audience don't see his face. And then they go back and they hear something at the door, but it's Muffin! Muffin survived! Maybe Muffin survived. And then there is an amazing jump scare, I think definitely trumps the jump scare at the end of Part 1, where Jason lunges through the window at Ginny, breaking it, and we see Jason's uncovered face with this long red, like red neck hair, That scene took three takes to do, to get correct. And Amy Steele said that she was absolutely terrified filming that scene because the scene was going to be in slow motion. They had to use high speed film to shoot it. So she's in front of this window, which is going to be broken through, and she knows that that's what's going to happen. But then when the camera would start, she could hear the film rolling, and she knew that he was going to come through the window, but didn't know when. So her entire body would tense up. So it was a lot of work for Amy Steele as an actor to not register that that was going to happen. Took three takes to get that right. But then we dissolve, and Ginny's on a stretcher and saying, "Where's Paul? Where's Paul?" So it makes you wonder, like, what, just like kind of in the first movie, like, was that with Jason coming through the window? Was that a dream? Was Muffin coming back a dream? Because that dog that's dead in the woods looks a lot like Muffin. It's unclear. Now, let's talk about who played Jason, because like I said, this is the only movie where three actors played the character of Jason Voorhees. We already talked about the first, but for the other two, there's a little bit of controversy. Warrington Gillette is credited as playing Jason in the end credits. Steve Dashkowitz is credited as Jason's stunt double in the credits. So, again, there's different stories on this, but what most people seem to agree on is that Warring Gillette played Jason unmasked at the end, like through the jumping through the window scene. Lauren Marie Taylor has also gone on the record stating that Warrington Gillette was her Jason. He played Jason when she got killed by the character. Problem was, Warrington Gillette he wasn't like a stunt person. He couldn't do the stunt. Couldn't do like big stunts. So they hired Steve Dashkowitz, who's also known, has also become known professionally as Steve Dash. And he did the rest of the movie. So Steve Dashkowitz, according to him and according to some others, did the majority of the scenes as Jason in this film. It's unclear exactly what happened. But Steve Dashkowitz has also said that, you know, because wearing this burlap sack with all the running that Jason does, the burlap would irritate his eye because the one eye was exposed and actually got rug burns around his eye from filming this movie, which sounds just incredibly, incredibly painful. So Friday the 13th Part 2, I think, is a really interesting step in this franchise because, you know, the first movie is very different. You know, the killer in the first movie is dead. Jason is dead. But because it was so successful, they've got to keep it going. So Friday the 13th Part 2 happened. And they had to kind of start to reinvent the mythology, reinvent the world of what these films could be. And I think it's a really interesting movie to watch in that way, because it's not quite the Friday the 13th that would eventually become famous that a lot of people think about, but is kind of halfway there on its midpoint. And that's a really interesting thing, because again, the Halloween movies, the Nightmare on Elm Street movies really arrived fully formed into what they were as films. But Friday the 13th, it's really not until the third movie that it becomes what most people remember it by. And I think that's one of the things I love about this series is, like a child, you get to watch the movies grow as they go along. All right, to finish us off now, we're going to do our bad reviews section. And there's one in particular that is really fun. One review. The Clarion Ledger wrote, "Friday the 13th Part 2 obviously does not pretend to be any more than it is. A cheap, dime store cheap thriller aimed at the adolescent market. It is designed to be predictable enough to make the average fourth grader feel sharp-witted." But the most virulent review of Friday the 13th Part 2, which I'm going to read a huge chunk of, came from film critic Roger Ebert. And he wrote, The pre-title sequence showed one of the heroines of the original Friday the 13th alone at home. She has nightmares, wakes up, undresses, is stalked by the camera, hears a noise in the kitchen. She tiptoes into the kitchen. Through the open window, a cat springs into the room. The audience screamed loudly and happily. It's fun to be scared. Then an unidentified man sunk an ice pick into the girl's brain, and for me, the fun stopped. The audience, however, carried on. It is a tradition to be loud during these movies, I guess. After a batch of young counselors turns up for training at a summer camp, a girl goes out walking alone at night. Everybody in the audience imitated hoot owls and hyenas. Another girl went to her room and started to undress. Five guys sitting together started a chant, "We want boobs." The plot. In the original movie, a summer camp staff was wiped out by a demented woman whose son had been allowed to drown by incompetent camp counselors. At the end of the film, the mother was decapitated by the young woman who was killed with an ice pick in the beginning of part two. The legend grows that the son, Jason, did not really drown, but survived and lurks in the woods waiting to take his vengeance against the killer of his mother and against camp counselors in general. I guess. Now, the movie is a cross between the mad slasher and dead teenager genres. About 24 movies a year feature a mad killer going berserk, and they're all about as bad as this one. Some have a little more plot, some have a little less. It doesn't matter. And then there's an asterisk. This review will suffice for the Friday the 13th film of your choice. And I find this all hilarious, and the reason why I quote it at such length is that Roger Ebert was the screenwriter for my favorite movie ever made, Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, which was directed by Russ Meyer, came out in 1970. It's a great movie. Please watch it. It's so bad. It's wonderful. But it is that movie is softcore porn and genuine camp where the actors play it straight, but it's so funny. But the movie also ends with an extremely graphic massacre inspired by the Manson murders, which had happened just a few months before they made the movie, including the very graphic, you know, on-screen killings of young women, including a woman having a gun inserted into her mouth while she's asleep, and she starts sucking it like she's sucking dick, and then gets her brains blown out. Roger Ebert wrote that, and yet, 10 years later, he has the gall to criticize the Friday the 13th movies for being brainless and exploitative. Lovely, lovely. All right, my friends. I look forward to seeing you next week for Friday the 13th, Part 3, where Jason finally gets his famous hockey mask. I hope you have had a good time watching this movie along with me, and we have 6 more nights at Camp Blood to go. Pleasant dreams.